Welcome to Reviving Growth Keynesianism, a podcast about economic thought from the mid-20th century and why it matters to us today. Our goal is to fan the flames of a growing conversation on inequality, growth, and aggregate demand, so that we may hopefully arrive at a place of better well-being for all. Today's guest is Monica Prasad, professor of sociology at Northwestern University, where she studies economic, political, and comparative historical sociology. She's the author of numerous books and articles, including The Politics of Free Markets, The Land of Too Much, and Starving the Beast. Our discussion will mostly be confined to her book, The Land of Too Much, American Abundance and the Paradox of Poverty, in which she addresses the question of why the U.S. has more poverty than any other developed nation. Her response, which involves both the demand-side theory of comparative political economy as well as detailed historical analysis, is both strikingly obvious and overtly paradoxical. It is surely a hypothesis to be grappled with in an age where the futures of progressive politics and economics in the U.S. are riddled with uncertainty. I hope you enjoy our discussion.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Nick Johnson, and I'm coming to you today from the University of Chicago's Center for Spatial Data Science.
And I'm your co-host, Robert Manduca, coming to you from the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
In today's episode, we talk with Monica Prasad, professor of sociology at Northwestern University. In her book, The Land of Too Much, she develops a fascinating account of a comparative political economy that's based on how countries regulate demand. Essentially, she claims that the reason the U.S. has a weaker welfare state than Europe is not that Americans are somehow more culturally averse to government intervention. As she shows, the U.S. government intervenes in the economy all the time, often in ways which are much more confrontational towards business than in other countries. Rather, the reason the U.S. developed differently is that we faced a fundamentally different problem from Europe in the early to mid-20th century. The U.S. economy was too productive. It's a viewpoint the Keynesians would recognize. Prasad argues that the way the U.S. squared that circle was through what she calls mortgage Keynesianism. The government provided credit, primarily through subsidized mortgages, so that American consumers could buy enough to consume everything that our enormously productive industries were producing. Building on the centrality of the mortgage in the U.S. economy, after talking with Prasad, we discuss an article by Kaysu Park on the history of foreclosure, which originated in the seizure of land from Native Americans. Foreclosure would go on to be a central element in what made American mortgages unique.
Monica, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're glad to have you here. So I wanted to ask to start, in The Land of Too Much, you introduce what you call a demand-side theory of comparative political economy. Could you tell us a little bit about how thinking about aggregate demand has played a role in your work and what's different about this approach compared to the approaches that other scholars have taken and why it's taken so long for them to think about how states regulate demand in their economies?
Yeah, so I was very excited to hear that you guys have this podcast and this project going on because aggregate demand and underconsumption turned out to be really fascinating. So I got into this because I was trying to solve the question of why the U.S. has so much more poverty than other countries. Why is this the case when it seems that we know how to address poverty? Why is the welfare state so consistently small, or at least why is it so consistently not effective at reducing poverty in the ways that European countries can? And so, you know, I sort of was tracing back the history as one does, and it ended up at the Great Depression and the Second World War as the sort of point where things might have gone differently. And then I fell into this really interesting, really exciting literature on the Great Depression as caused by overproduction or underconsumption. And to me, it was really just blowing my mind, just these debates that people were having about how it could be that American productivity, which is something that for decades had been the goal, right? You know, there had been all these efforts to make things more productive, how it could be that it seemed to have led to this very strange outcome of Great Depression. The line that people were drawing was that farmers were very productive. This led to a lot of goods on the market. This led to low prices for all those goods, which meant that farmers, when they sold those goods, couldn't actually sell them for very much. This meant that they had taken out loans from banks, you know, for their implements and everything, and they couldn't repay those loans. This meant that the banks were falling into crisis. And so this was a sort of thread in the literature that which is really fascinating about how production could actually lead to crisis. It was really just really interesting at a sort of archival level to see people kind of struggle to make sense of this and kind of try to wrap their minds about how could this possibly be? What is wrong with capitalism? What are we doing wrong here? And I talk about in the book how it leads some set of thinkers to reject capitalism, to argue that we really need to go into a sort of more communist direction. And then others, of course, move into these other kinds of patterns that I trace in the book. So I guess that's a long response to your question about how did I actually get interested in this stuff.
No, it's a fascinating story because, yeah, as you say, on its face, the idea that there's too much stuff being made, therefore we're all in poverty, or therefore poverty is widespread, or, you know, people are going out of business. It's just so counterintuitive. And yes, it's sort of what people saw and certainly how they interpreted it back in the Depression.
Yeah, this was the rhetoric at the time, and then economists later dismissed it. But there is actually some evidence for this being what was happening. The economic explanation, what most economists argue, is that it was the gold standard, which artificially constrained the economy. And of course, that's true. But I go into this long thing in the book about, well, without getting into the complexities of it, decisions had to be made about whether or not to allow the money supply to grow. And I look at why those decisions were made in the way they were. And so one of the things I tried to argue is that it was precisely the productivity of the American economy that made it impossible to figure out, well, what is the right level of money? Like, what is the right money supply, right? So ultimately, I do think that economists talk about this as, they don't say things like, this is blowing my mind. They say there was a supply shock, you know, so the supply shock was the 19th century and early 20th century productivity of the U.S. And there was also a demand shock in terms of the money that was there and then that could allow this supply to actually get distributed across the system.
Yeah, because one of the things that comes through is that you describe, you know, after the fact, when economists tried to explain what went wrong, it was like, oh, they should have known to expand the money supply, or they should have done monetary policy better. But in the moment, as you say, like very compellingly, is nobody had ever seen this much economic growth, and they just didn't have any idea what to make of it, basically. And, you know, how on earth?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, otherwise, all you can do is say it was a mistake. It just happened to be a mistake, you know, and it's true. It does seem to have been a mistake. But why was that mistake not recognized at the time? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's the context of knighting uncertainty that the like second industrial revolution as an event produce.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's always easy to do this in retrospect, right? Okay, clearly the monetary supply was, you know, not loose enough, but yeah.
So on this podcast, we're actually really into typologizing the different kinds of Keynesianism. In the intellectual history, it goes through these different phases of, you know, sort of like Great Depression, interwar Keynesianism, the original Keynes. But then after the war, it splits between this like Cambridge, UK Keynesianism, which is sort of closer to the original idea. But in America, you get MIT Keynesianism, which eventually evolves into New Keynesianism, which is a kind of like financialized version of all of this. But you, I think, have a really great typography, which is you have mortgage Keynesianism in America and then social Keynesianism in continental Europe. Can you tell us a little bit about that, what these two different models are and where they come from?
Yeah, and this is building on work that other scholars have argued about a kind of privatized Keynesianism in the U.S., you know, where increasing consumption is the goal. And the main thing I tried to point out is that the really key feature of that increasing consumption in the U.S. is mortgages. Like the central thing that people spend on in their lives is the house, and the mortgage is really the big thing. And so I sort of trace back, why did this seem to be? So to get back to the underconsumption, so one of the suggested policy solutions at the time was that if the problem is that we have all the supply, we just need to get people to consume more. And so there were all these efforts thinking out how to do this. There was like literally like eat more pancakes and like stuff like that, you know, to get rid of the wheat, etc. But so this idea of the fixed rate 30-year mortgage kind of emerged as one of the ways to get the economy going again. So the idea was that making it easy for Americans to borrow and making it sort of safe for them to borrow would lead to a sort of stimulus for the entire construction industry. And the construction industry would be a stimulus for the entire economy. So that was the idea. Mortgages sort of as the key to creating consumption in the U.S.
Right. And I guess that sort of highlights the difference between what might on the face of it seem identical ideas, which are underconsumption and overproduction. They both get at this idea that there's a mismatch between supply and demand. But the solution to overproduction is to produce less. And in the course of the Great Depression, there was a lot of that. You know, there's a lot of just like slaughtering pigs that you don't need and then just like throwing them in the river, which is just a huge waste. But then underconsumption points to this idea that actually you can just increase demand, and that sort of solves the problem in a more productive way, arguably.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, there are these attempts by producers to kind of get together and restrain consumption and things like that. But yeah, this ultimately seemed to be the most important political economy innovation that emerged out of all of that thinking.
And then, of course, like later, as the dollar becomes the global reserve currency, there's this massive inflow of capital that is just eager to finance American mortgages.
Yeah, I actually talk a lot about that in my most recent book, Starving the Beast, and how that sort of opens up this space for neoliberal tax cutting, which otherwise would have been much more costly than it has been.
In terms of thinking where this comes from, and especially why, you know, in the United States, we go in this sort of mortgage Keynesian direction, whereas in Europe, they take a different approach. One thing that you talk about in the book is how there's this key distinction between the US and Europe that goes back to the late 19th century, early 20th century, which is that, again, as we mentioned before, that the US farming sector especially is just growing so productive, and that this causes very different reactions on different sides of the Atlantic. Why were the reactions so different, and what were they?
So one of the issues was that when there was this problem of too much supply, everyone turned to protectionism. All the countries did. And the US, in fact, was one of the initiators of it. But it was the American farmers' own productivity that was the problem. So protectionism wasn't itself enough of a solution here. And so, you know, so there also had to be other things. And so one of the things that is really interesting about what's going on in Europe at this time is that they see what's happening in America, this amazing productivity, and they're kind of freaking out. There is this torrent of writing and worrying about what they're calling the American invasion, by which they mean American products coming into Europe. And so they're thinking, well, how did this happen? What do we do about it for the first decades of the 20th century? And one of the things that happens in Europe is they end up arguing that in order to compete with the US, we have to figure out how to improve production, how to increase production. And they, through, you know, complicated processes that are different in every country, I don't want to suggest that, you know, Europe is a monolith or anything, but you can see this thread of sort of state-directed development in various ways, this sort of top-down attempt to catch up, which in many ways is sort of what we might today call supply-side oriented, in that it's actually oriented towards helping the producers, helping the big firms who then, partly because of state aid, become competitive on export markets. So this is the strategy that they develop. And in terms of my original question about the welfare state, I argue that the welfare state is part of this strategy, because the strategy requires restraining consumption among the public. And then the welfare state is a way to sort of get Europeans to buy on to that strategy, to that way of doing it. Whereas in the US, the welfare state isn't actually the big problem that everyone is struggling with. I struggled with this a little bit because it's harder to explain an absence. So, you know, I looked into one of the key things that I ended up studying was Huey Long in the 1930s. I did the start of this project because I wanted to solve poverty, and I ended up spending, you know, like a year studying 1930s agrarianism in Louisiana. So basically. So I was looking into, well, why doesn't Huey Long has, of course, this very progressive kind of share our wealth program. He's the one who pushes for progressive taxation. And I wondered, well, why doesn't he care as much about healthcare? Why is he not pushing as much for healthcare? And there's no, it's hard to point to a definitive answer to that. But he wrote this memoir that says what he would do if he were president. And, you know, healthcare is part of it, but it's almost like an afterthought. It's like, oh, we're going to make this hospital that will treat everyone. We're going to make hospitals that will treat everyone, you know. And so I think what's going on is partly is that healthcare is not necessarily, or paying for healthcare in the way that has become key now, is not necessarily as central then. Health improvements are partly a function of public health campaigns, and medicine is just not as advanced as it is now, so they're not necessarily thinking about it as the issue. Instead, the key issue is they're thinking about this question of, well, how do you spread the wealth? How do you get this wealth that is in the hands of, the rich monopolists? How do you get it into the hands of everyone else so they can actually buy things to prevent this kind of economic collapse? And so I argue this leads to the strategy of increasing consumption, and things like progressive taxation to break up concentrations of capital. So, yeah.
I guess that, again, comes out of just the unique abundance of America, right? Whereas in Europe, markets aren't necessarily particularly large, and so you don't get the kinds of increasing returns to scale you get in America. And then the farmers in Europe, they can sort of hide from the price declines produced by American grain by throwing up tariff walls and then agreeing to this welfare state. But you can't cut out toxic people from your life if you're the toxic person. And so American farmers, have this problem that they're just so incredibly productive that they're pushing their own prices down. They can't defend themselves with tariffs. And so then I guess they naturally just go after the monopolists, who they think, the railroads are the traditional ones, but also Eastern bankers. And I guess that sort of accounts for some of this. These antagonistic politics, right?
Exactly, yeah. And this, what Elizabeth Sanders calls agrarian populism. She has this terrific book examining agrarian populism from the turn of the 19th century for several decades afterwards.
In the first chapter of the book, you describe, imagine at the turn of the 20th century, a farmer was going to go on a bunch of American farmers go on a grand tour of Europe to see how, these supposedly different and perhaps better state models are intervening in the economy. And you talk about how in all the areas that they care about, what are they doing against monopolies? How are they regulating railroads? All this sort of stuff. They would be totally shocked that, Europe isn't ahead of the game at all. In fact, they're lagging. These countries are lagging the U.S. in the areas that the farmers would care the most about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I've wondered why there is such a strong perception that the U.S. is a country in which the state is small or which the state doesn't do much. And I've often wondered why that perception has lasted so long in academia. And, it's partly because it emerges out of examination of the welfare state, which is not as effective as the welfare state in Europe. And I think, kind of gets metonymically generalized as reflective of the state as a whole. But of course, in many ways, the American state has been much more progressive and much more adversarial to business. Glass-Steagall, for example, the kinds of separation between commercial investment banking was not really common in Europe, or until the rise of Ronald Reagan, at least, and in some ways beyond as well. Taxation was more progressive in the U.S., whereas in Europe, the states are financed by national sales. A big chunk of the state is financed by national sales taxes, which scholars think are regressive. They fall more on the poorer than the wealthy. Yeah, so I have wondered, I haven't done a sort of sociology of knowledge to figure out why do we see the American state as so small, though people have given me suggestions over the years. One historian at Columbia thinks that it has to do with the role of scholarship during the Cold War, in that scholars were trying to produce this sort of picture of, a sort of freedom-loving U.S., and things that fed into that were produced and things that didn't were not. I think it's partly also a function of the extreme division of labor of academia. So when I was doing the literature reviews for this, I would come across so many books and articles that would say things like, well, we all know the American state is small, but in the specific area that I examined, it's completely different. In the specific area of regulation, in the specific area of progressive taxation, whatever, and what a surprise. And you keep coming across these over and over. I think partly it's that in many areas, many disciplines, you don't actually look across domains. So this is one reason I'm a big fan of comparative historical sociology, which is that you're actually encouraged to look at the big picture. And it turns out that sometimes if you look at the big picture, you see things that specialists are not seeing.
Yeah. And I thought the other part of the point of contrasting the farmer's tour at the beginning of your book, when an imagined farmer goes to Europe and looks at and sees how backward Europe is that it's a response to progressive tours of Europe that were actually conducted by bourgeois thinkers, right? So like all these urban intellectuals who go to Europe and they're like, oh, why don't we have any of this? But America was largely an agrarian nation at the time. And so arguably the progressive disappointment with their own state isn't reflective of Americans' own sense of what they were doing.
Yeah, and of course, we in academia are descendants of those progressives who were going on those tours. You know, in sociology, we're descendants of those progressives. Absolutely, yeah. So it's the farmers weren't going on those tours, and the farmers didn't leave legacies of intellectuals who came after them. So
I guess all of this sets up actually your first book, in a way, which argues that there's a kind of uniquely antagonistic politics in Anglo-America that you don't find in continental Europe. And this explains something about what happened in the back end of the century, why neoliberalism was so much more revanchist and powerful in the US and UK than it was in France and Germany.
For 20 years, I've been trying to answer this question of why the US has more poverty than other countries. So in the first book, I was examining the rise of policies of the right, basically Reagan and sort of the free market revolution of the 80s and 90s. And I did come across all this literature that I was mentioning that was suggesting that in various domains, the US is actually much more progressive, much more adversarial than European countries. And so I kind of traced out, well, what happens? And, you know, arguments that have been made are that sales taxes, these regressive sales taxes that are a big part of the revenue base of European welfare states, are much more stable. They're a much more stable source than progressive taxes. And there is some literature to suggest that this is true, that sales taxes create less political opposition because they're less visible. And they also are less damaging to the economy. Some economists argue that. So this kind of regressive revenue structure ended up financing these effective anti-poverty strategies, whereas our attempt to be politically progressive kind of backfired because it undermined the revenue basis for the state. So that's part of the argument. I also talk in that first book about regulation and the specific structure of welfare policies.
Yeah, that was one of the most striking observations to me in reading these, was just, you know, this idea that progressive taxation, which people on the left especially are so in favor of, and, you know, even to the point of when a sales tax is suggested, it'll get shot down for being too regressive, that actually may be hurting the overall goal of having a, you know, a larger welfare state or that sort of thing. And it seems like both because it just generates less money is one of the things that you describe, and then because it's like such a clear target for businesses or whoever's getting hit with those extremely high rates, is they, you know, their first priority is, you know, lighten these taxes on us, whereas in Europe they don't.
Yeah. Or even like aspirational middle class voters.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to say, too. It's not just the wealthy who are opposed to taxes on the wealthy.
Yeah. So if you were going to put on sort of a recommendation hat, would you say that we should be thinking more about consumption taxes, or are there ways to do progressive taxation that maybe doesn't have some of these weaknesses?
Yeah, you know, I go back and forth. We have this little group of fiscal sociology scholars, and we talk a lot about this question. And, you know, it does seem to be the case that progressive taxes are less stable. On the other hand, you know, given how much the very top of the income distribution has benefited in the last 20, 30, 40 years, it's hard to argue that they shouldn't be paying more. You know, I did a kind of back of the envelope calculation, and I think you actually have to do both. You've got to raise capital gains taxes, you've got to close the carried interest loophole, etc. And I do think that, I mean, if you want a European-style welfare state, you're going to need European-style taxes. That said, you know, this is what history tells us, but history also tells us that people come up with new ways of doing things all the time. So, you know, there might be some sort of American model of poverty reduction that we have yet to see. So it's a long-winded way of saying, I'm not actually sure. I do think some sort of, move towards national sales taxes would be a good idea.
I've seen some people talk about this on the left that, you know, aspirationally down the line, you know, once you have fewer wealthy people, then you can't rely on taxing the wealthy for as much of your welfare state.
Right. Yeah. And it's also worth saying that it was not the case that in most of these countries in Europe, national sales taxes didn't necessarily result from some sort of populist campaign or anything. It was often, for example, in France, it was just that there was nothing else to tax. You know, as if you've read Piketty, you know that the fortunes of the wealthy were very, very bad in those years. And so you had to tax the middle classes if you wanted to do a welfare state. So it wasn't necessarily a strategy in those cases.
So speaking of like an American model of a welfare state, in The Land of Too Much, you talk about how in the U.S., basically what we've ended up doing is using credit, not just for consumption in general, but specifically to cover some of the functions that are taken care of by the welfare state in other countries. Can you describe how that works and what are some of the implications of that?
Yeah, so what I did in the book is I did this quantitative analysis of credit versus welfare in European countries. This also is building on arguments that other people have made, and basically just showing that countries that controlling for a lot of other things, countries that rely more on the public welfare state rely less on credit. And in particular, it seems to be for housing and healthcare that Americans are borrowing. So if we are worried about financial volatility, when people buy on credit, it creates this sort of question about whether they will be able to repay, creates all these kinds of financial reverberations in the economic system that we saw in 2007-2008. And so I argue for that reason, moving towards a more public welfare state would actually be a beneficial thing in the U.S. in terms of, even if you don't care about the poor, you've got to care about financial volatility, right? You've got to care about the health of the economic system.
So people in America are borrowing more because they don't have a welfare state to rely on, so they just sort of have to, right? That's the argument?
Well, yeah, if you look at the comparative spending figures, where Americans spend much more than Europeans is in housing and healthcare. Healthcare is complicated because partly it's because we have this system that just leads to such high-priced innovations. But yeah, so housing and healthcare are the two things, and getting control of those two things would lead to less borrowing on the part of Americans and thus to less financial volatility.
So a Medicare for All scheme would also be a kind of anti-financial program.
Yeah, exactly. That's the implication.
So I understand that. I understand the argument for Medicare for All, reducing the power of finance and why that's sort of a good thing for the left or progressives or whoever. But reducing mortgages in America, I mean, people are pretty happy with their mortgages, right? I mean, we just saw an election in which wealthy white suburban districts came out in force, en masse, to reject Bernie Sanders and to, you know, shove Joe Biden onto the national spotlight. And then, you know, I'm just thinking globally, financial markets depend on American mortgages. So that's what makes our financial system so liquid and deep and uniquely attractive. That's what one of the things that makes the dollar such a powerful currency. And so given that that's sort of one of the pillars of our strength internationally, is that something we should be messing with?
I mean, it has costs as well, you know, and so one of the questions is, did we fix the system after the financial crisis of 2007-2008? You know, if we did, then the costs of it are a lot less. I'm not sure we actually did. But yeah, I mean, obviously your point is well taken, that these kinds of changes, it's hard to imagine them happening. Even a really small change in these directions, like taking away the mortgage income tax credit or just, you know, reducing the amount of it. It just seems almost unthinkable. I mean, Trump did it to some extent because he wanted to hurt Democratic constituencies who benefit from that, you know, so he did it to some extent. But, you know, even something like that is just so hard because it's so popular that, you know, pretty much everything is kind of set up on this way we have of doing it. And you know, there's also the question of, the U.S. is kind of the world's consumer in the last resort, right? Mm-hmm. So if we were to reduce consumption, who would consume, you know? So there is that question. And, you know, I would argue that perhaps there could be more of a sort of role for consumption in developing countries.
Especially China.
Yeah. And there is a system that has developed based on all of these assumptions that were put in place. And so changing any of this would be very difficult and would, you know, would cause changes in lots of other aspects as well.
Yeah, so in a sense, you know, the two models that you set up, the social Keynesian, low-wage, high-welfare spending, export-driven economies of, like, say, for instance, Germany, that's predicated on the idea that there are export markets out there, which means that there has to be some kind of mortgage Keynesian American-style system out there. Otherwise, the other half falls apart as well. So there's, I mean, what's so great about your book is that it's like a world systems analysis, right? In the sense that, like, everyone sort of, like, the global system allots you certain parts, and then that affects domestic side.
Yeah, and that's also what makes it hard to envision, you know, an easy answer to this. Although, mm-hmm. you know, my line is I just think there should be more balance. So.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I was struck when you were talking about even the difficulty of changing the system, like even when people start to agitate for change, like you described the role of consumer advocates in the United States when they're starting to press for more, you know, a better deal for consumers. What they ask for is more access to credit. They don't ask for a welfare state or for anything like that. So it's still within this framework.
Yeah, because, you know, if you're someone who wants to improve the conditions of life for poor people in America, pushing on access to credit is pushing on an open door. Pushing for more welfare is a lot harder, you know, and as we know, a lot of the history of restricted access to credit is about racial restrictions to credit. And so it's very hard not to argue that this should be something that is removed, right? You know, so it's this odd way in which progressives and conservatives, you know, people from all across the political spectrum end up pushing for more credit.
Right. And gendered as well, right? I mean, like, for a long time, I think you talk about, like, divorced wives who suddenly don't have a credit record anymore.
Yeah, in a system that is predicated on access to credit, that is a real hardship, you know? So it's easy to see. It's easy to see why going down this path leads to going further down this path.
So I guess that brings us to the last question, which is, I think, a really tough one that I certainly don't know the answer to, which is that this history is, like, so rich with irony and paradox and unintended consequences that it's... The question is, where do we want to place our faith in the future, right? So, like, the hero of this story, in a way, are the farmers, the agrarian statists who build the American state and the welfare state in Europe. But today there are more people who play World of Warcraft than farm. And so the farmer isn't actually going to be the social actor who makes the strategic alliances to get where we want to go. But as a materialist, you know, we want some kind of socioeconomic, sociopolitical agent that has that capacity. Is there anyone in your mind that has the objective interests, the strategic leverage, and the kind of, like, I don't know, know-how to actually reform the system, to, like, take on American finance?
I'm not sure if I would say that my argument is a sort of farmer-centric argument. Definitely they play a key role, but they are being pushed in particular directions as well. You know, so they're operating under certain incentives. So, you know, one reader who read my book was a little bit skeptical, saying it's actually all about geography. Like, you know, it's geography that ultimately seems to be destiny in this book. And, you know, there is an argument for that, you know, but I think that if we do want to say that there is a scope for agents, I would say that if there's any agent right now, it would be the state, you know. So I see my work as kind of in this state-centric model that over the course of the last centuries, the ability of humans to coordinate action has multiplied in many ways. And it's that apparatus that is really a big part of what happens in history in the 20th century. And so, which is also not to say that state actors are completely free either, but I do think the kind of looking inside the state and what's going on there is really where a lot of the exciting action is.
As an observer, I guess, of the current moment, are there any trends that either give you hope or that you would encourage people to focus on or to push for today?
I have been very intrigued to think through what the progressivism of the last 4 years means and, you know, what it means that radical young activists are now on the stage in a way that has to be taken seriously. This is definitely very interesting. And I mean, I'm sure sociologically you can explain it with things like rising costs of college, et cetera, and, you know, reaction to neoliberalism, whatever, but in which direction is this going to go? But I'm not sure in what direction it's going to go, precisely because of these ironies that you suggest and strange consequences that you suggest. You guys brought up before this debate about college tuition between Biden and Clinton, in which Clinton actually seems to be the more progressive one because she's targeting to those who need it. And
I don't want to pay for Donald Trump's kids to go to college.
Exactly, yeah. And Sanders is the sort of less progressive one, the more kind of universal one. And it's such a strange debate because in Europe, the left has often been a little bit skeptical of college for everyone. Or, you know, paying for college for everyone, on the argument that it's the children of the middle class who benefit from this, and even working class students who go to college end up in the middle class. You know, so everyone is paying for this benefit that kind of privileges the middle class in this way. I mean, it's definitely fascinating to see this kind of new progressivism in America. I'm not sure what that's actually going to lead to. So we'll see. Maybe Kamala Harris will get us out of all of this, right?
Yeah. I mean, certainly looking at what happened to the last time the United States was more progressive or was leading in terms of being, you know, in a progressive direction, and how that, yeah, the consequences of that were not necessarily what the progressives maybe had in mind.
You mean Barack Obama? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's sort of where we're at as well on the podcast, is we've sort of been joking around about this idea of young Keynesianism, which is supposed to be a kind of reference to the young Hegelians, Marx's phase of life when he hadn't quite committed himself to the idea that the working class or the proletariat was going to be the agent of history, the subject of history. You know, but he had sort of identified these problems that he was concerned about, but he didn't quite know how to get there. And I think that's where we're at as well. But at the same time, you know, youth does suggest, as you sort of said, like, you know, the activists that are out in the streets these days are rather young. And I think that sort of interacts with the increasing financialization, increasing inequality and slowing growth to make class heavily mediated by age, so that actually youth, you know, is a significant marker of where you are in the socioeconomic system, right?
Yeah. And I guess I would say the one thing that gives me a little bit of hope is that I do think that Reagan and his folks were wrong to say that the welfare state is always bad for economic growth. You know, I do think that there are lots of government interventions that actually are beneficial to economic growth. You know, part of I think the next moves, kind of figuring out, well, what are these, you know, rather than sort of being caricatured as this kind of, you know, more state, less state kind of argument, we've got to do a better job of actually specifying and being precise about exactly which interventions. You know, like, I think the case is pretty strong for health spending and education spending. Other kinds of spending is a little less clear, so.
Yeah, and I think that's exciting. And I think that the fact that people are starting to make that case in those terms, that, you know, this is not about, like, we're rich enough that we can afford to spend money on healthcare. It's about that actually the way to grow the economy is to make it so that, you know, people are able to work and don't, you know, immediately fall off a financial cliff when they get sick.
Yeah,
there are clear economic benefits.
Yeah. And, you know, there are even Republicans who are starting to make this argument, you know, sort of a free market welfare state. So,
yeah, kind of muscular statist nationalist economic program, right? Well, thanks for coming on. It's been really enlightening to talk to you.
All right, yeah, thank really you. This was a lot of fun. Best of luck with this. This was really interesting.
So that was our interview with Monica Prasad on mortgage Keynesianism in America. And immediately after recording that, we came across this really great article in the journal Law and Social Inquiry from 2016 by Kay Sue Park, titled Money, Mortgages, and the Conquest of America, which is about the particularly American origins of modern mortgages. So we thought that would be a really great article to kick off our reading series with. So the article begins with this distinction between real and personal property, or land and chattel property, which in medieval England was very, very strong. So this distinction was essentially that you could alienate personal property, you could alienate chattel, but you could not alienate real property, land.
And by alienate, you mean take or seize in response to a debt or something like that, or sell even, I suppose.
Right, exactly. So land was, much of the land was entailed in the sense that you couldn't sell it because it just belonged to your noble estate, and the noble estate was a family possession. You couldn't, you know, individuals couldn't sell it. But even smallholders, it was very, very difficult to actually get them off the land.
Right, which is so different from how we think of real estate or real property right now. I mean, it's like, you know, the idea that it's impossible for somebody to take your land or even for you to leave it, you know, is very strange to the modern American sensibility. Yeah.
Right. So there were all sorts of forms of credit, and you could use parts of the land as collateral for that. So if somebody lent you $100, then your land was kind of at risk, in the sense that they could, take a lot of the corn that you produced that year, or for the next few years until your debt was paid off. Or They could rent it out on your behalf, or they could put a debtor in prison. They could also seize your personal property, so they could take your chairs and your tables and your couches and stuff like that. But they actually couldn't take full possession of your land in perpetuity, because the land belonged to your family. And even when they did take partial control of the land in order to rent it out to somebody else or to farm it themselves, creditors had obligations as well. They had to take care of the land for you, and actually you could sue if they wasted your land or if they caused you a nuisance, which is a legal category, while you were on it. So being a creditor was not quite as, you know, it didn't offer you the kind of joys of cruelty that maybe modern credit relationships do. And in fact, in addition to all of that, even if it was seized, because you could write special contracts where you would alienate the land at the end if you couldn't pay it off. Even in those kinds of contracts, which were very rare, you could usually buy it back from the creditor at a reasonable price within a reasonable time frame. So if you could somehow recover the money, you could repatriate, literally, you know, your patrimony.
Interesting. Yeah.
Huh. So how did that all change when in the United States?
Right. So lending with land serving as a collateral came to England in the 11th century, and it was called a gauge. And there were two types of gauges. There was the vif gauge and the mort gauge, the living gauge and the dead gauge. And with the vif gauge, basically what happened was the fruits of your land would pay off the debt. So every time you produced wheat, the profits from that would go to paying off your debt. But in the mort gauge, the dead gauge, the fruits of your land would basically serve as interest payments on the debt, and you'd have to find other ways of paying it down. So it was much more profitable to lend it a mort gauge. Hence, that became much, much more popular. And over the course of the early modern period, there was increasing ability to take over the land by the creditor. But again, you know, you couldn't actually alienate it. You couldn't actually seize it. You couldn't foreclose on somebody and kick the peasants off their land. You had to maintain it. But then two events in the early 17th century sort of changed what happened, or how this stuff worked. The first was that Parliament legalized interest in 1623.
It's a big change.
Yeah, big change. So you could actually loan at interest. And so this created a whole, this was one of the beginnings of the modern English financial system. But money that functioned on the basis of credit was born at that point. The other event was that the English established colonies in Jamestown in 1607 and in Plymouth in 1620. And these colonies were really starved for credit. There weren't many banks that came to America in the first century or two. And gold bullion was actually rather rare. The Spanish were mining the hell out of Latin America, and so were the Portuguese. But most of that actually went back home to Europe. And so the colonists in North America were basically in the wilderness, and they didn't really have much circulating paper money. And so they needed to find other forms that money could take. And famously, you know, they used wampum, which were these like shell beads that the Native Americans used. They also eventually figured that they could use tobacco as a form of money. Adam Smith talks about using nails as money as well, as a kind of like a store of value, unit of count, means of exchange. But what Casey Park points us towards is the use of land as a kind of money, or credit based on land, the mortgage, as creating a kind of money. And what happened in America in particular was, after the colonists had become enmeshed in trade with Native Americans, which they had to be in order to survive, right? I mean, like, you got to remember that English colonists just sucked at everything. They would have starved to death in the cold if it weren't for the Native Americans, if it weren't for the fact that they figured out ways to ingratiate themselves to Native tribes to get resources, get food, get shelter, and get the knowledge that they needed to really make it in the New World. But after they had become enmeshed in these trade and exchange networks, one of the things that they immediately wanted was to expand, to import more population, to have kids, and to expand their land holdings. And so one of the things they did was they tried to insinuate English notions of credit into the Native American economy, which they found to be very difficult, according to Casey Park, because Native Americans didn't really have credit in any kind of modern European sense. What they had was exchange and barter, but also gift exchange, right, which had a very like highly ritualistic component to it, and was used for the purposes of diplomacy and like alliance building. And that's obviously not at all what English credit was about. English credit is about acquisition, and it's about accumulation, and it's about building formal power and control over resources. It's very much antisocial in that way. But I think Casey Park implies that they tricked the Native Americans because of what she calls the contact economy, which is a situation where two cultures that have mutually incomprehensible modes of understanding resources and exchange come into contact with each other. Right. So, like I said, Native Americans did not think of credit at all in the same way as the English did. But they were trading, and they were trading on credit.
Got it. Yeah. So you have these two groups that have very different understandings of what trade is about and credit, you know, how it exists or what it is, if it is anything. And the English are able to use their sort of force their in understandings or insert their understandings into these existing networks, I guess, in order to start extracting stuff.
Right. And I guess the other like crucial context that she says you need to understand what's going on in this, the like early mid 1600s is obviously the plague and the like the socio-demographic, political, cultural crisis of Native peoples in America. You know, ultimately their population was decimated by something like 90-95% got wiped out. And so, you know, it's in that context that the Europeans show up and are needful in the beginning of Native help, but then also have these resources to trade. And ultimately, what winds up happening is that Native American politics gets reoriented by who can best exploit trade with Europeans. So that's sort of what trade meant to the different sides. And ultimately, you know, these kind of political ambitions were something that the English could take advantage of as like new leaders, new like entrepreneurs tried to basically, you know, save their culture. The English developed a practice of predatory lending to Native Americans, even though they knew they couldn't pay it back in any like, you know, standard European sense. But with the intention of using that as the pretext to then take the land by force.
And is this where the idea of alienating the land really comes into its own in the colonies?
That seems to be what her argument is, yeah, is that this is where the idea that you could foreclose on somebody and just take their stuff and like all of their stuff, not, you know, the distinction between real property and chattel property that we started with, where you can take their couches, but you can't take their land. That's something that the colonists decide isn't going to fly in the New World, that they're just going to take the Native Americans' land. Right. Which I guess I wish the article would have gone into a little bit more detail with, because, I mean, the way that it comes off in the article is that it's purely predatory, right? It's just purely for the desire of having a pretext for expansion. But part of me does wonder if the contact economy is characterized to such a great degree by mutual incomprehensibility. You know, presumably the medieval English mortgage would not have functioned particularly well, right? I mean, if you lend a member of the tribe money and then he's not able to pay it back, coming and saying like, okay, well, now I have rights for the next 20 years to your corn production. I mean, that's presumably going to be very hard to enforce, right? So any English creditors that participate in the contact economy would be hard pressed by the lack of mutually comprehending institutions that would actually be able to enforce any kind of mutual understanding. Hence, violence is this sort of that's what happened.
Right, when you have lack of understanding and people are differently interpreting what they've agreed to or what's going to happen as a result of these trade agreements, that's a recipe for problems down the line.
Yeah.
Right. But then even if it maybe was, maybe if the germ was that the Mort gauge wouldn't have worked, the fact is that eventually, or very, very quickly, there are these really shitty Europeans who figured out that, oh, okay, well, now if we're collapsing this distinction between real and chattel property, if we can't just foreclose and take the land, well, then I'm going to do that. I'm going to intentionally lend, and she has these examples of these European creditors who would intentionally lend at far too high a price. They knew in advance that they were not going to be able to pay it back, and it was intended to be that way.
To provide a pretext for seizing the land.
Right.
Yeah. 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 No, that reminds me. I was reading The End of the Myth by Greg Grandin, which is a book about the history of the U.S. frontier and the idea of the frontier. And he has these amazing descriptions of, I think it's Thomas Jefferson, you know, at the founding of the American Republic, being like, here's what we're going to do. We're not just going to go out and invade the Native American lands around us, but we're going to start, you know, implementing predatory lending schemes in order to get them to go into debt, and then we'll take their land as a result of their inability to repay. So it was an idea that stuck around for a couple hundred years, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. What's so interesting about the article is the intervention that she's making, the kind of like point that she wants to bring up, is that everybody kind of knew that foreclosures were an American invention. They you know, it was sort of, it's well recognized that, you know, chattel versus real property was a real distinction in Europe, and that in the course of American colonization, it disappeared. But what people had not yet really taken seriously is the fact that it started not as a process that took place between Europeans, but a process that took place between Europeans and Native Americans, that it was really quite intentional that this was an imperial project. And that's the reason that I wanted to read this article today, is because we talked with Prasad about the origins and implications of mortgage Keynesianism in America. But we didn't really talk much about where the mortgage itself came from and how that was tied in with the origins of America in settler colonialism. So one of Prasad's points was that America was a uniquely commodity export-oriented economy, and that this distinguished it from, say, the European core. But one of the points that we didn't get to that she does discuss a little bit in her book is that all settler colonies are this way, that Australia is this way, New Zealand is this way, and then Canada is also this way, right? That like the original purpose is to settle and then to export some primary crop like cotton or tobacco or sugar or something like this. And that gives them a very different place in the global political economy. And then what this paper is outlining is that, you know, in addition, the process of settler colonization itself, when it brings you into these contact economies, also has unique effects.
Yeah, like even in the process of creating the settler colonies, you know, before you get to the late 19th century, where they're suddenly all becoming incredibly productive and re-exporting their commodities to Europe, just the process itself of confiscating the land to begin with is responsible for setting up some of these unique institutions and putting them onto a different path.
Right. Yeah, because part of the reason that there was this real chattel distinction in Europe, part of the reason that you wanted to have land protected in this way is precisely because social order and social stability depended on it. You know, even if you're an English lord and you are a creditor to your peasants, you still kind of want the peasants to be happy, and you still kind of want the peasants to respect the feudal order of things. You don't want a great mass of people who are landless, identityless, and have no idea where they fit in the system. You want everybody to kind of know what their place is, and making sure that everybody kind of had some access to land was a part of that. So protecting real property was a part of that. But when you're dealing with the process of settler colonization, ultimately the goal is expansion, not social order. It is taking away from others. It's a zero-sum game in that case. And so expansion becomes predicated on the zero-sum violent logic.
And yeah, I think that's sort of important for understanding. You know, otherwise it's just the contact economy seems like this kind of, you know, mutual misunderstanding, but not necessarily with a direction to it, or with a positive side on one end or versus a negative side on the other. And it's what it's bringing the force alongside the contact economy. That's what really makes it, you know, something that is expropriative and violent.
Right. And so ultimately, though, you know, all of this was backed up, as we've been saying, by force. So this was all in some way a pretext for seizing the land and foreclosure. So, you know, violence is very much sort of backstopping the whole system. So Casey Park writes, credit and conquest were inextricably linked in colonial America.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things that she drives home, is that the result of this was that there was suddenly a lot more, you know, land became a basis for liquidity, which meant that the amount of credit and just the amount of money in the economy skyrocketed.
Right. And so if the massive productivity of the American economy is based on land holding, then how you get the land in the first place is really important. But then also, if the mortgage is kind of the undergirding feature of the American financial system, then the ease with which Americans or could be foreclosed upon becomes one of the central drivers of financial development in America, right? So, this is sort of, again, going back to what her intervention is people kind of knew that the real chattel distinction broke down in America, but they thought that it had to do with Europeans talking amongst themselves. But in fact, this is a story of blowback. This is a story of a boomerang effect. So what happens first in the process of colonization then comes back to the dominant society. Right, so experiments that were first, you know, these experiments in predatory lending, which were first perpetrated on Native Americans, when you foreclose on Native Americans, then it becomes sort of like, eventually becomes common sense among American colonists. Oh, well, of course you foreclose on somebody. Of course you just kick them off your land and take the land if they can't pay the debts they incurred from your credit. Well, ultimately that comes back to bite the colonists, because then the colonists apply that logic to each other, which again is sort of like creating these conditions that are super favorable to the creditor in America. And this is one of the reasons that credit took a flood from the European mainland into America, is because of our uniquely liquid credit markets, which, and the liquidity itself is based on foreclosures.
Yeah, we see this line going straight from, you know, current mortgage Keynesianism or 20th century mortgage Keynesianism back to super productivity among the agricultural sector in the 19th century. And then you can actually even go back further, we're seeing with Park, to, you know, the original invention of the modern mortgage or the foreclosure, modern foreclosure, to dispossess the land in the first place. So you see this, yeah, this line straight through the entire history.
Because Park does, like, one of the big things that sort of came up in the Prasad interview, right, was that she doesn't quite believe in social agency. Right? I mean, her theory of agency is principally Hegelian. It's based on the state and state actors, and state capacity, becoming ever more powerful structurally and more complex. But here we see two nations come into contact, and Park really emphasizes the agency of Native Americans in terms of having these cultural structures, which then have these effects on English colonists, that the English colonists basically take advantage of, it seems like. This just goes to underline the extent to which political economy can never just be about economics, right? It's always about processes of racialization, gendering, and empire at the same time. Right? And these aren't peripheral, and they're not super structural. They're sort of centrally determinant. So I guess as we think about young Keynesianism today, you know, it's important not just to think economically, but also to think politically and culturally.
Yeah, that's a good lesson to keep in mind.
Reviving Growth Keynesianism is produced by me, Brandon Murphy, as well as Jonathan Kenyon, with assistance from our researcher and archivist, Michael Donnelly. The podcast is supported financially by the UChicago Program on Professional Advancement and Training for Humanists and Humanistic Social Scientists, and the Micro Metcalf Internship Program. If you enjoyed this discussion, please follow us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and consider leaving us a positive review, which will help us connect with more engaged listeners like you. More information on our ideas can be found at revivinggrowthkeynesianism.org. There you can also find our Patreon. We would greatly appreciate if you chose to support us. All donations allow us to put out more content for thoughtful listeners like you. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.